the realization of justice comes from allowing and enabling individuals to think for themselves, to live according to their own conscience, without fear of violence, without fear of control, let alone persecution.
The death of a 22-year-old Kurdish woman at the hands of Iran's religious police has launched the country into weeks of widespread and historic anti-government protests. What began as a sudden and unexpected outpouring of anger by Iranian women has quickly evolved into a sweeping and unified coalition of voices, calling for everything from scrapping Iran's punitive female dress code all the way to overthrowing the Ayatollah himself and the religious elite that have dominated Iran and Iranian politics since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Now young Iranians say they want a new revolution, with the image of Mahsa Amini at its center and the rallying cry of Zan Zendegi Azadi, women, life, freedom. Dr. Katir Damian is an international human rights expert, an Oxford University alumni who worked with USAID, UNHCR, and the UN Human Rights Council, and is currently a lead advisor at the New Zealand Human Rights Commission. I sat down with her to talk about what's happening on the ground. So, Dr. Erdamian.
Beautiful.
Thank you very much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you. And it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you about a couple of things, at the foremost about the situation in Iran, the ongoing protests that we have been seeing for the last few weeks, historic protests. It's unclear exactly where it's headed, but I think it already has proven something. And the whole world is paying attention to what's happening to this protest movement that is led by women, for women, under the banner of women. Mm. As somebody who is from Iran, how do you read what's happening there at the moment? What does it look like to you?
Mm. Well, first, thanks for having me, Mohammed. I think for me, it's no matter which way you see it, I think there's, you know, with anything, any political moment in history, you're going to have different viewpoints. Mm-hmm. And there's a spectrum of them. Sometimes they're quite divisive. So some would argue to use the word protest would be to undermine what is happening, that this is a revolution. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think, you know, whether we're talking revolution in the terms of a change in the regime or some other kind of social cultural revolution, mm-hmm. I think in some ways it's apt to use that word in the sense that it has ignited a desire that's been in the hearts of the majority of the Iranian population, the majority of whom were not alive during the 1979 Islamic Revolution, mm-hmm. and who have grown up in a country that they didn't really ask for. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, I think if we were even to just kind of avoid all of the various agendas, the, you know, the various calls that are out there, in and of itself, no matter what happens, a revolution of sorts has taken place. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a profound moment to bear witness to from a safe distance, almost from a very, unfortunate distance for many people like myself who are part of the diaspora. It's odd seeing this all happen on your iPhone, mm-hmm. on your laptop. So it moves the heart and it ignites the mind. And I think it connects a lot of people and from diverse backgrounds, mm. you know, irrespective of what people's backgrounds are. So, yeah, it's a very unique and many describe it as an unprecedented time in Iranian history. Mm. You know, not even modern history, just history.
From a personal but also professional perspective, as somebody on the outside looking in, how do you follow what's happening and where are the places that you are getting most of your information, given that oftentimes with a country like Iran, it can be difficult to be able to get up-to-date information about what's happening?
Yeah. So you may be aware that the government has cracked down on the internet. So not only has it censored, different platforms of internet use, but generally the availability of the internet. And there's been entire blackout, periods of entire blackout in the country as well. So yes, it's very difficult to get information. But I think, like, you know, from your home place in Egypt, when the Twitter revolution, it's sort of similar now. So people are relying on Twitter, on Instagram. And for me personally, I'm trying to avoid a lot of the commentary, actually, because I'm not sure it's actually the time for that right now. I think what I'm more interested in is what is fact. And the only facts that I can attest to is what I see by way of images and videos that have come through. And there are various individuals and organizations, human rights organizations, that are collecting this information. They verify the accuracy of what's going on, and then they share what's been verified. And some of it's heartbreaking. Some of it's very scary. And some of it, for many, is very inspiring. Yeah.
And you mentioned Egypt and the Arab Spring and the Twitter revolution. And social media has kind of continued to play this role between people on the ground and governments that are trying to retroactively catch up with the kinds of controls that they impose. What has been happening in Iran in that regards? You talked about internet blackouts. What has been happening between the people on the ground and between the systems that are trying to control that information?
Again, I think if we remember that the vast majority of the population of Iran is young, under the age of 30, 35, it's very hard to get verified statistics about the sort of the reality of the demographics of the country. But we know, I mean, it is a given that the vast majority are young people. And actually, the vast majority of protesters are, you could argue that they're children, you know, between the ages of 15 to 17. And they're tech savvy. They're the tech savvy generation. So they have their ways. And of course, there's still a crackdown despite them being able to surpass some of that. And but I think that's how they're surpassing it, you know. I know that there's all sorts of, arguments or arguably conspiracy theories on how this is all happening. But I guess I think it's the same. Like, you know, if someone is filming something on their phone, there's only so much you can actually fabricate with that. You know, what you see is what you see. Call a spade a spade.
Yeah,
it's hard to dispute when you see certain acts of brutality, an escalation of violence against peaceful protesters. And I acknowledge that the protests have taken a turn, as in they have changed in character over the past week or so. What started off as quite peaceful, but still incredibly impassioned protests, they have taken an increasingly violent characteristic, which is no good from a human rights perspective.
And again, there's so many echoes, you know, and it almost feels like within the region we've kind of seen echoes of this before. And I wanted to ask you about the slogan that's kind of taken hold as part of these protests, as part of this movement, which is "Woman, Life, Freedom." And to me, it reminds me of "Bread, Freedom, and Social Justice," which was the slogan that came out of Tahrir Square in 2011. Do you think there are similarities between what happened during the Arab Spring and what's happening in Iran now?
So the slogan was initially, it's a Kurdish one. Jinjian Azadi, Zan Zindagi Azadi is Farsi, to say, woman, life, freedom. And I think it is significant to note that it was a Kurdish slogan, and this movement sort of began from the Kurdish people, who we know have historically been oppressed by the Iranian government. And that sort of impassioned cry comes from like a intergenerational struggle of the Kurdish people in that land to seek recognition of their existence, just first and foremost. You know, we should note that Jina Mahsa Amini has been called by Mahsa because her Kurdish name Jina is not able to be legally recognized in Iran, right? So she's even had her
because it's
a Kurdish name and you can't legally register your Kurdish name in the country. So just recognizing that. And I think if we were to link it to other movements or other calls for justice and equality in other contexts across the region, it's telling a common story of humanity, right? Like, it doesn't matter actually what background you come from, what your identity is. There are some basic fundamental human rights that all people are deserving of, because if they have inherent dignity, nobility, right, and value. And so that sort of fundamental nature, if after generation, the numbers are also being oppressed more and more, whereas, you know, there was first it's just one particular minority or a small minority, maybe then it's two minorities. But then once it starts to reach the more general population and it starts to take on other characteristics and in a lot of contexts it might be economic, you know, and where it sort of hits the majority of the people, then you realize that actually that minority's pain has now become your pain. Right. And then the story is, and it's going to be this way, I think, for all of humanity until we wake up to that fundamental truth, which is that we are connected and that as individuals, we all have the right to these basic fundamental human rights, and that states and governments have the responsibility to ensure that the people who are in their jurisdiction and under their authority have these rights protected and realized. And there's only so much that a human being as an individual can endure suffering and oppression. But imagine, you know, once you start multiplying that and it becomes more and more entrenched, then it's like a pot boiling over, you know. People won't take it. We've seen it in a lot of contexts.
I want to ask you about Mahsa Amini and where this burst of energy, of protest, of anger came from. It started with the death of a woman at the hands of the morality police. What, from your understanding, happened in that moment and in the moments that came afterwards?
Yeah.
And how did that connect to this movement that we're seeing on the streets now?
Yeah. So what we know is that Jina Mahsa Amini, she's a 22-year-old. She was a 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman. She was visiting Tehran, which is the capital city of Iran. Big city, bustling city. She was visiting with her family, and she was wearing her compulsory, state-mandated hijab, which is, you know, the religious covering dress. And so she was wearing it, but she was wearing it loosely or arguably improperly. And in Iran, there is something called the morality police. The morality police is designated by the government to patrol the streets and enforce this compulsory hijab and other dress codes and also behavioral codes, particularly against women. So she was arrested by the morality police, or the so-called morality police, and taken to what's called a re-education center. And there she we have accounts that she, eyewitness accounts, that she was brutally beaten, that her head suffered 11 blows, and she was then hospitalized. Now, there's this famous photo of Jina Mahsa that we see where she is sort of incubated in the hospital and in a coma state. This photo was leaked from another young woman and who also took photographs of the hospital records, which is why we have this proof that she suffered because of blows to the head. Now, the government says that she suffered from a heart attack and that is what caused her to go into a coma, and she subsequently died a few days later. Now, this is not a story that in and of itself is unique to the kind of the collective experience of women across the country. But in some ways it was a watershed moment. And it is significant that it happened to a Kurdish Iranian woman. One, because of the way in which Kurdish people commemorate and recognize their grief. Mm. So that cutting of the hair, that's a ceremony of grief.
Really?
And that's where that symbol comes from, where at the funeral they cut their hair.
Mm.
And so it was from that, you know, we have the symbols of the burning of the hijabs, we have the cutting of the hair, and we have the woman life freedom slogan that has come from it. And so for many people, they're saying we, as like another part of the slogan, is that we are all Mahsa, you know, and so a lot of the women, again, from diverse backgrounds, are seeing themselves in her. And for those, and for all of the women who have suffered in the past, who we may not know their names, but are part of that same history.
So that's really fascinating, because this is the first time I've heard that the act of cutting off a hair is kind of a ceremonial thing. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
There's actually a really iconic photo of another Kurdish Iranian woman who died during the protests. Mm. And the photo is at her gravesite, and her daughter is standing next to her mother's grave, just sort of holding her hair in her hand. And you've seen images of women, whether they're in Iran themselves or outside, or their supporters and other women who want to show solidarity for Iranian women. They're also cutting their hair to join in that symbolic resistance, I guess, to the oppression of women.
It's really interesting to hear the where that symbol comes from, because I feel like in some ways it's taken on more meaning as it's become very symbolically attached to these protests. And a lot of it seems to have to do with women and control over women's bodies, but their hair more specifically.
Mm.
What is the experience of women in Iran today, and why has the death of this one woman resonated so powerfully with women across Iran?
Mm. You know, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the state mandated hijab, it came a few years later. If I'm not mistaken, it was enforced by the government in 1983.
Mm.
So when the revolution first happened, it wasn't like an overnight thing. But I think once women started to realize that this was being imposed, again, irrespective of a person's religious beliefs, there are, of course, many Iranian women who wish to wear the hijab or more, and would wish to express their faith in that way. But for those who do not, it is enforced on them. But again, this hijab, it's a symbol of wider oppressions. It's not, in some ways we could argue that it is a piece of cloth, while simultaneously acknowledging that for many Muslim women in Iran and elsewhere, it is more than just a single piece of cloth, right? So I think we can hold both of these these complexities in our hand and treat both sacredly. Whereas a lot of the times it's sort of seen as okay, it's just a simple act of just taking this off as if that's what it is. But then coming with the sort of the mandatory hijab came other restrictions. So there are many restrictions on women's participation in public spaces. In Iran, you know, you've got the infamous restrictions around women not being able to attend sports games and sports stadiums, you know. So you've got accounts of young women putting on like fake mustaches and, you know, cutting their hair short and so they can go and like watch a football game. And which seemed like very sort of almost trivial and unimportant acts, all the way to not being able to travel without the permission of your husband, and other restrictions around your freedom to choose what you want to do as a career, what you want to study, all sorts of restrictions around your bodily autonomy. So it's and then the I guess one of the more overt and daily threats of just violence and harassment on your person, by virtue of being a woman, your worth is considered that as being half of a man. And this is, a lot of it's been codified. So we're not just talking about something that's a cultural matter or something that is arguably even just a religious matter. This is an interpretation of Sharia law by the government, by authorities, and codified in particular ways to subjugate and oppress women, obviously for certain ends. And that has, that, you know, that's been generation after generation after generation. And again, if we're thinking about what's happening right now, you see that a lot of the protests are also from young women, young girls in high schools, even in elementary schools. We've had footage that comes out from children and young girls in elementary schools who are coming out. Needless to say, their schools have been gassed and... but, you know, these women are also coming out and saying, this is not the freedom that we want for ourselves as well. As young women, there's the segregation of women from in schools, in universities. You know, it just, it really cuts through all the different layers of one's, like, participation in social life, the ability to make choices freely, and they're all taken from them.
And what is the consequence for some of these young women going out to protest, going out and visibly removing their hijabs or burning them in a public place? What are they risking by being in those spaces?
They're literally risking their lives. And we have, unfortunately, a number of verified deaths of young women, some in incredibly brutal circumstances. That have included violations to them by authorities, and that's arguably the most extreme outcome. But you know, you can just go and look. I mean, there's verbal harassment, there's physical harassment, there's, you know, there's actual physical violence as well. And I don't think we understand entirely the degree of bravery it takes for a young woman to go up out on the streets and visibly do that. For us, maybe in the comfort of our homes, it doesn't seem like such a remarkable act, but it is literally them choosing to do that in the face of potential death.
This is somewhat of a philosophical question.
Cool. I like that.
When I was living in Istanbul a few years ago, I interviewed and interacted with a lot of young women who had experienced kind of the flip side of this during the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s, where hijab was outlawed, the headscarf was outlawed in a lot of public spaces and institutions and schools. And so, you know, you mentioned young women going with mustaches to attend sports games. You have pictures of schoolgirls going with wigs over their hijabs to allow them to enter these spaces. And there was a huge protest movement there at the time, and eventually it was overturned after years, decades really. And you have also more recently what's happening in the United States with abortion legislation and this conversation around the control of women's bodies in general as a principle. And in a lot of societies where governments try to exert themselves, there seems to be this thread where women somehow always end up being at the front of where the brunt and the force of power comes down. Why do you think that is?
Oh, because women are... to be feared. You know, I think if we want any future where there's true progress, true development, then the equality of women and men has to be realized. That's the theoretical answer to your theoretical question. But like on a very serious note, I think, you know, these different examples, and because this has come up a lot, that what is being described as the whataboutism kind of counter-argument to what's going on in Iran. around, is this imperial feminism? You know, are we looking down at the, is this a way of the West saying, oh, look at all the Muslim women who are being subjugated and all of that? And I think there's two responses to that. One is that we need to understand the specific context of Iran and the ways in which religiosity and diversity is allowed to take place or not allowed to take place in that country. That is actually quite distinctive to that specific context. That's one. And the second is to say, you know, at a very fundamental level, for every individual, the realization of justice comes from allowing and enabling individuals to think for themselves, to live according to their own conscience. And that includes to be free to practice their belief or non-belief without fear of violence, without fear of control, let alone persecution, right, or discrimination. And so if at the very core level, whether you're talking about the United States, India right now is in the news, in Turkey where you were, or in Iran, what we're talking about actually is the absence of justice at a fundamental level, because we are taking control of a person's fundamental human right to think for themselves and to live according to their own beliefs. And when you do that, then what foundation are you laying in any land for other forms of justice to be realized, you know? And I think that's what we're seeing in this context, is that, you know, you have Iranian women who are devout Muslim, who for in their interpretation of being a Muslim, that includes the wearing of the hijab, alongside secular atheist Iranian women, who for them, the hijab is a symbol of oppression. And they're both saying woman, life, freedom. So what is that in terms of a lesson, I think, for all of us when we're looking at the context of Iran? And rather than pitting almost the liberation struggles of women around the world, sort of pitting them against each other to say, what is it that we're actually wanting to realize in the world? What kind of a world do we want to construct and create? And what narratives help unite us towards that future, rather than create a space where we're sort of having to vie for attention? And a lot of it, if we want to get a little bit personal, I think a lot of it comes from people's trauma, you know, particularly if they've suffered religious trauma. And, you know, even in the context of where I live in Aotearoa, New Zealand, you know, the expression of a person's religiosity has become a very sensitive point, particularly after the March 15 terrorist attack, where, you know, Muslim worshippers were massacred by a white supremacist. And so naturally that you know, it becomes almost a point of protection. What is it when you're burning the symbol, are you also burning away everything that we're trying to say we need by way of protection, by way of respect, by way of honor, by way of reverence? And if we move away from that vying and we look towards forms of solidarity, and I think part of it is to like raise things to the level of principle. Like, what are the principles that will help us unite, rather than necessarily getting embroiled in some of the specificities that will just cause future divisions?
It is a thing.
It's a thing. It and we have thing. To acknowledge that it's a thing.
And I think there is a sensitivity around it. Yeah. And as there was a sensitivity, I saw the same kind of conversation coming up when the Taliban reclaimed power in Afghanistan, and what that meant for women that had rights stripped away from them. There was inevitably people that were using it as an example to say everything they wanted to say about Islam and Muslims and just generally that part of the world. And there were people that were very protective and refusing to engage with that out of fear of trying to feed something that they felt was being taken advantage of. But how do we put both of these things aside and really elevate what the voices that deserve to be heard in this situation. I mean, from your perspective, how do you kind of avoid those pitfalls, or is it just about ignoring them and not falling prey to that conversation?
Yeah, no, I think elevating to the level of principle is a really beautiful, constructive way of going about this, and also through empathy.
Mm.
And call me a hippie, but through love. No, and I mean it, because if we, you know, so one example in the terms of the Taliban, if we were to agree at the level of principle that any forms of extremism or fundamentalism and are detrimental to the rights of people, and that often extremism and fundamentalism are just avenues for power and greed to be manipulated and misused, then we can agree that there is a space here for us to call out the negative effects of that extremism and fundamentalism, right? So, because we can't ignore it. You know, in terms of the context of Afghanistan, when the protests started and the woman went out, guess who was also out in front of, on the streets? Afghan woman. And they were holding up the same signs, you know, and they were saying woman, life, freedom. And they were saying, and this was in the face of literal guns being pointed to their heads saying, you know, you can't be doing this. So there's something that connects us. And if we look to that, irrespective of where we are, then we can build towards something.
In the last few years, we have seen protests in Iran. We have seen people coming out in different cities, but we haven't seen it happen like this on this scale. What is happening in this moment in Iran that has pushed people to, as you mentioned, risk their lives to be able to go out in the face of the threat of losing their lives?
Yeah. So, I mean, the significant difference between what's happening now and, say, the 2009 or 2019 protests, which were particularly about kind of political reform, is, you know, this started off, as we've been discussing, about women's rights in Iran, what the death of Mahsa symbolized for wider gender oppression in the country. And, you know, we've also seen men come out on the streets, particularly young men. Again, I was saying before that, you know, a lot of the protesters are around 15, 16, 17 years of age, 18 years old. They're young. They were not alive during the revolution. And so the slogan has changed. Some of the groups are becoming very clear about what it is that they're asking for. They are calling for the overthrow of the regime. And I think, you know, part of what's leading up to it is, of course, some of the economic difficulties that have been arguably imposed on Iran from the West when it comes to the sanctions, but also a recognition of the corruption in the country when it comes to how the economy is run, people becoming more aware of that. You know, we've seen that some of the oil factories are going on strike to sort of, you know, in recognition of that disparity and that inequity. So there's the economic side, there's the gender side, there's also just sort of across, I guess if you were to broadly say, like a social, cultural call for change in the sense of people recognizing the history of minority oppression, whether it's religious or ethnic, the situation of LGBTQ minorities in the country, and, you know, the recent death sentences of two LGBTQ activists. There's also the, I guess, the broad restrictions around people's freedoms to live. And, you know, again, a lot of these young people, they're getting insights about what life is like for a lot of people outside of Iran, and not people. It's not just in the West. I mean, they're looking at their neighbors as well. You know, they're looking at Jordan, they're looking at Lebanon, they're looking at Turkey, and they're seeing how a lot of their young families, some of them are family, some of them are people that they don't know, and they're seeing the kind of life they're living, and they're saying, hey, how come I'm not getting that? And so they're linking it to a sort of a broader call for a change in the country.
I want to ask you about the issue of minorities in Iran. And we can start with Mahsa Amini, a Kurdish woman. You mentioned the workers going on strike in petrol factories. Some of them, a lot of them, were Kurdish. What is the situation? What is the unique issue for Kurds in Iran with regards to what they're fighting for right now?
I mean, Kurds have for a long time been oppressed in the country, have been discriminated against. Their language has been, attempts to erase the cultural and linguistic identities of the Kurdish people. And you know, there's a lot of the strong backlash against the protesters has been focused on Kurdish regions. Mm. So the Kurdish region of Sanandaj, for example, recently has come under literal gunfire. People were describing it as a war zone. So on one level, it's been a collective, I guess, process for the Kurdish people. You know, I mean, it's the same for Kurdish people in other parts of the region, calling for a recognition of their existence, first of all. And then there are, of course, groups that are asking for independence as well.
And with regards to not only ethnic minorities, but religious minorities, what has that experience been like under the regime that began with the Islamic Revolution?
I mean, there are some protected religious minorities in the Iranian constitution. What is described in the constitution as people of the book. Under the constitution, you know, Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians are recognized. That does not mean that their human rights are fully realized, but they are legally recognized. The largest non-Muslim religious minority in the country, the Baha'is, have long been persecuted in the country and have suffered, particularly since the 79 revolution, what's been described by the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion or Belief as state-sanctioned persecutions. Mm. So it's like a systematic way of trying to eradicate the existence of the Baha'i community. And we see it, it's been part of the kind of the history of Iran as we know it. But I'd say generally when it comes to, you know, diversity in the country, it's one of those things where you think if a woman cannot go and select how she wants to present herself in public, then, you know, to what extent is there also like an attempt to kind of control the way in which people think and practice their beliefs? Whether privately or publicly. So you can just kind of maybe get a glimpse of the levels or the various layers of atrocities that happen in the country.
I've been trying to find this quote, speaking about Baha'i women specifically, because I've seen this quote being shared a lot online, but also from what I'm understanding on the ground in the protests, and it's a quote attributed to Persian Baha'i leader and poet, Fatima Barghani, who I think is called Tahiri.
Tahere.
And the quote is, "You can kill me as soon as you like, but you can't stop the emancipation of women," which feels quite profound given the context of what's happening right now. And I want to ask what does that quote mean to you? And what do you think it means to young Iranian women?
You know, Tahereh was arguably the first feminist. And she actually, was the first to unveil herself in a crowd of men. And you can imagine at the time that she did that, it was such a revolutionary act that, you know, there are accounts of men slitting their own throats after seeing her do that.
This happened from what I've gathered in 1852.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So you can imagine, I mean, what a significant act that was. And so, you know, it comes back to these fundamental truths that we were talking about earlier. You know, you can't have a future that is advanced, progressive, united, dynamic, diverse, without, at a very fundamental level, having the equality of men and women realized. If women are not achieving equality in all spheres of life, then even the advancement of men is not possible, right? So you're not even holding back, you know, as a like a an ambiguous concept of society. You're talking about people, like men, women, all of us. There is no future where women are subjugated or oppressed. And so in some ways, it's a full circle moment to see that kind of that history playing out again, where people are calling for that. But I think these are lessons that as a collective, we're going to keep learning. Either the hard way, through pain, through suffering, unfortunately, as we see, through violence, or we can find those points of unity that we were talking about earlier, come to that realization and work together, like-minded people, shoulder to shoulder, trying to realize these lofty principles we're talking about, the level of principle, what do they look like in practice? And then we'll see a new world.
Beautifully put. Dr. Danielle, thank you very much for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Mohammed.